The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Bali Tosfos and the Golden Age of French Jewry, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilu Nishmos, Rabbi Yosef ben Rabbi Yonah Michal HaKohen Zal, V'ishtoi, Moris Elka Bas Rabbi Shol Mordechai Olea Shalom, Uvenom Meir Yehuda Zal ben Rabbi Yosef HaKohen, and to the memory and Le'ilu Nishmos, Ruben ben Chaim Alevi Olea Shalom, Rufuma Bas Aryeh Leib Olea Shalom, Mr. and Mrs. Richard and Florence Liss, a blessed memory. From the period of Rashi and on, the Torah world, first in France, then Germany, later in Israel, Spain, and North Africa, underwent a virtual revolution whose effects are felt to this very day. In fact, the miracle of Jewish survival and vitality, both physically and spiritually, is due in no small part to the intellectual excitement generated in 12th century France in the shadow of Rashi's birthplace, Troyes, Troyes, some 150 kilometers southwest of Paris on the Seine. Since the completion of the Talmud throughout the Gaonic period, although there was constant analysis and discussion of the text of the Talmud, it seems that the major focus in the yeshivas of Babylon and all the countries under their sway was the preservation and memorization of the original text of the Talmud, and also the preservation of the received understanding of that text, as they had traditions dating from the Rabbanan Savaroy, the period right after the Talmud, as to the correct interpretation of the text. There were new innovations introduced in that period, but by and large they lied in novel systemizations and reorganization of the various sections of the Talmud to different formats, based on either the Torah portions, such as the She'iltas, or a condensation of the Talmudic format, such as the Halachas Gedolos, of the Shimon Kaira, or Rabbeinu Alfasi, or a new systematic format of legal topics, such as those first used by Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Chai Gaon, and later on, says the Rambam. It seems, however, that this was not the case in Italy. The Italian yeshivas during the Gaonic period put a much greater stress on the analysis of the text and original resolutions of apparent contradictions and other difficulties. Although this approach to Talmudic study eventually influenced Spanish and North African scholarship in the 10th and 11th centuries through the four Italian captives, Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbeinu Chanoch, Rabbeinu Hushiel, Rabbeinu Shmaryo, and influenced Ashkenazic scholarship in that period through Rabbeinu Kalonymus and Rabbeinu Meshulam of Lucca, all subjects of previous lectures, for the most part, their dynamic approach and analysis has not been preserved. Their approach, however, blossomed further in France during the time of Rashi's descendants, the Bali Tosfos, the masters of the Tosfos, or editions, has remained a vital part of the permanent legacy of the Jewish people. This unique system of textual analysis, nurtured and expanded by the masters of the Tosfos, coupled with a breathtaking sweep of the entire Talmud and related sources, is avidly studied today by Jews throughout the world. In fact, these Tosfos, or additions to the commentary of Rashi, are printed on the outside margin of every Gemara, and are a part of virtually all Talmud study from high school level and beyond. Eventually, the Tosos were seriously studied in Spain, and this approach, which was already dominant in France, became enriched and expanded through the genius and erudition of such Spanish scholars as Ramban, or not from Ben Moshe, a subject of previous lectures. His disciples, Rajba, Shlomo ben Aderes, Ra'ah, Rav Aaron Alevi, in Barcelona. Their disciple, Ritva, Rav Yom Tov, in Seville. And eventually the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, in Barcelona. The early history of the school of the Balei Tosfos, the French scholars from the time of Rashi's disciples to the time of Rashi's great-grandson, Rabbeinu Yitzchok, known as Riyah Zoken, is the subject of tonight's lecture. The history of the later Balei Tosfos will be covered in subsequent lectures. When speaking about the Balei Tosfos, the authors of the penetrating and insightful additions to Rashi's commentary, I'm reminded of a Gemara in Horios in Yudalot Amud Aleph in 14a. After Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi had heard of an important halachic opinion that was stated in the name of Acherim Omrim, literally other unnamed scholars, he asked his father, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, as to their identity. Who are those unnamed scholars? Like in the language of the Gemara, Mi halolu, mihem halolu, shimei mehem onushosim, ushmosam ein onumazkirim. Who are these people from whom we drink their precious waters, but make no mention of their names? In a certain sense, the same can be said regarding the Balei Tosfos. Although we are often privileged to know many of the names of the Balei Tosfos, we rarely have any inkling as to when or where they lived, who were their mentors, and what was their specific impact on scholarship and history. In tonight's lecture, as well as the succeeding lectures in this series, we will hopefully illuminate this relatively obscure period and give us a heightened appreciation of the giants of spirit and intellect from whom we continue to drink of their precious waters. The great scholarly contributions of the 12th and 13th centuries are rightly called Tosafos, additions to Rashi's commentary, as they are not only intellectually, but also to a great degree physically, a continuation of Rashi. The first generation of scholars that are mentioned in the Tosafos were Rashi's direct disciples. Some of them were also Rashi's sons-in-law. Besides for the Gaonim of Babel and the German mentors of Rashi, the earliest scholar other than Rashi mentioned in Tosfos is Rabbeinu Shemaya. Not only was he a disciple, but also a collaborator with Rashi, and eventually a mechutin, a father-in-law of one of Rashi's grandchildren. On your notes, here on page one, we quote now, this is from a response of Rashi, regarding interpretation of a specific verse in the book of Ezekiel, Yecheskel. It says, now I have studied the book of Yecheskel with our brother, Achenu, our brother, our colleague, Shemaya, and I have corrected my original misinterpretation. Evidently, he looked at him as a colleague. On paragraph B, we just quote that there's a gloss regarding that specific verse that Rashi recanted. There was an addition written onto Rashi's commentary by Rabbeinu Shemaya himself. And there's a question of scholars, perhaps there are other glosses or other additions from Rashi, actually not Rashi, but this Rabbeinu Shemaya, his colleague, his disciple, but in a certain sense a colleague. If you notice here, on page 2, in the first part of paragraph D, we quote from the Sefer HaYosher, which was from Rashi's grandchild, Rabbeinu Tam. And we're saying, this responsa was found in the bundle of Svorim of Rabbeinu Shemaya, the father-in-law of our master, my brother. He does not specify which of his brothers he was the father-in-law, but historians tend to feel that it's referring to his oldest brother-in-law, who was in a sense Rabbeinu, his master. This is Reb Shmuel, this was the Rashbam. So this Rabbeinu Shmaya actually was a disciple, in a certain sense a colleague, and a mechutin, was an in-law of Rashi's. Because Rabbeinu Shmaya is generally not well known, nor his contributions widely appreciated, I'd like to take this opportunity to share with you some of his teachings so that we can all, in a certain sense, also become his students. On the first page, here you go back on the first page, in paragraph C, part of the laws of the Hilchos Nida, the ritual purity, is that during the period that there's an abstention of relations, there's also adiv harchokos, there's a distancing. One of the harchokos, one of the distancing in that period, is not to pass objects from the husband to the wife and vice versa. The source actually is from Rabbeinu Shmaya. And here is his, and this brought Lalach, of course, in paragraph C, in the Machzor Vitri, this is the next topic we're going to discuss, but was written also by another disciple of Rashi. Rabbi Shmaya explained that Rashi was careful, as he witnessed as a close disciple, not to pass even a key directly to his wife while she was in Nida. Because of that, there was a reanalysis of the Talmudic text where Rashi would have gotten this from. But really, this is the source of the halacha. This is Rabbeinu Shmaya. You can look at all, I'm just going to touch upon this because of the length of these notes. We just quote from other instances where Rabbeinu Shmaya, this is not an exhaustive list, this is just a representative list, where Rabbeinu Shmaya is quoted. But I would like just to touch upon, and you can look at this yourself, another very interesting part of Jewish life. We know that one of the distinctions very often we find between Hasidim and non-Hasidim is that Hasidim, of the various distinctions, generally wear a gartel. In other words, they wear some sort of we can't call it a belt, but some sort of an over girdle. In other words, it's a long, piece of material that goes around when they come to daven. The source of that is based on a Gemara in Shabbos, on Daf Yudam et Aleph, where it's clearly stated that as a preparation for davening, and as the code of the davening, one should gird himself with a belt before davening. The question is the reasoning of those who do not adhere to this custom of putting on a gartel. One of the reasons, one of the schools of thought, there are various, one of the reasons, of course, is that putting on a gartel was understood there as a preparation for davening, because they didn't wear pants. That was not, the Slavs wore pants. The Romans, Greeks, the Jews, Babylonians, Persians did not wear pants. And the Arabs don't wear pants. They wore this long garment. The Slavs wore pants, and eventually, because of the brache, were called, and eventually they became part of the dress of Western Europe, of Western men. But antiquity, they didn't wear pants. There is a question in the Gemara. If one is just wearing a garment without undergarments, and it's just an outer garment, is one allowed to say brachos? One cannot say brachos, one cannot say benedictions if the private areas are not covered, the body. Does it have to be covered? But how far does covering go? Does it just simply have to be covered? It's not visible? Or there is a question, as a Gemara Chof Heim and Beis and Brachos, of what happens if it's covered over here, but Lev Royas Erva, the heart, in other words, this part section is exposed to the heart. The private area is exposed to the heart. There's no There's no girdle, there's no girdle, there's no belt separating the higher and lower area. Is that also permitted or not? And that's an argument. And there's a question how we rule about this Talmudic argument. Rabbeinu Shemaya was of the opinion, which we're going to read now, that we rule that one is normally allowed to say brachas, to say blessings, benedictions, shema, if all one is just wearing a robe where you are not, it is not visible to the eye, but it says a lev roysever, the heart, in other words, but below there's no disconnection, there's no gartel separating the heart from the lower part. He says you're allowed. However, when it comes to stan shmoneh esrei, the amida, when one is standing before Hashem, hikon likras, elokecha Yisrael, one must get extra preparation. There and only there do we demand this extra separation. So the purpose, according to Rabbeinu Shemaya, the purpose of the gartel was really only in that period of time where they did not have pants. So this is really to create that separation. When we have pants today, or underwear, there is no necessity. That's Rabbeinu Shemaya's opinion. The others disagree. Those who said, no, we rule that you can't say any brachas, you can't say any benedictions in that kind of a garment. And the purpose, therefore, of wearing a gartel is not to make a distinction between the heart and the lower part, because that has to be in any case. You couldn't say shema without it. But it's just an extra preparation that comes with davening. And that is at least partially the reasoning. Therefore, they maintain that Gemara that demands a gartel, irrespective of the type of clothing that you are wearing. But this is all part of this argument. But Rabbeinu Shemaya is a key figure. I just wanted to, because you never heard of him before, but he's a key figure in this argument. And here we have on paragraph D, and this is on the second, on the second part of paragraph D on page 2. Rabbeinu Shemaya, the disciple of Rashi, ruled that, like the first authority, that one is allowed to recite words of Torah even though the heart sees the private area. And this is the Tosfos brings this in Brochos 25b and Chofei Amud Beis. Now, interesting, it seems, we're going to see from the Kolbo here, which was a later collection, quoting this, it seems that Rabbeinu Shemaya's opinion seems not just his opinion, but he is a source of Rashi's opinion. And he quotes here, however, when the heart sees the private area, it is forbidden to study or pray. This is not like the opinion of Rashi, who stated that with the exception of the Amida, this is the Shemoneh Esrei, if you're standing before Hashem, it is permitted. Rather, it is like Tosfos' opinion, who disagrees. But again, the source of this, at least it has, is Rabbeinu Shemaya. And again, there are many other comments that this is just a representative sampling. One is an interesting thing. In the middle of davening, you are not allowed to talk. Beside all the, all the shushes and the gabai screen. But in the middle of davening, you're not allowed to talk. Specifically, of course, when you start Baruch She'amar, in the beginning, until you finish Shemoneh Esrei, you're not allowed to talk. Some people take liberty, but if it's in Hebrew, it's okay. That's not English, it's in Hebrew. So just specifically here on the bottom page 2, Rabbeinu Shemaya is quoted from Tosfos and Yigimol Amidal 13a. The one is forbidden to talk, when it is forbidden to talk, the prohibition applies even to the holy language, even to Hebrew. And this is Rabbeinu Shemaya. Rabbeinu Shemaya is interesting here. I mean, again, you can look at the other quotes, which is interesting. This is a fascinating quote. It's just the top of the page. By the Seder of Pesach, we dip twice. The first time we dip in Salzwasser, and as we dip in salt water, and the second time is in Charoses. The Talmud speaks about dipping the first time, does not specify what the medium of the dip is. However, if we could hear, it's interesting, Tosfos here in Psochem, Kufyud Dalet Amud Aleph in 114a, brings, this is not like the opinion of Rabbeinu Yosef Bar Elam, who wrote in his Seder, this was a Seder that he wrote, and he dips the vegetable in Charoses. He maintained the first dipping was also in Charoses. Rabbeinu Shlomo Rashi also expressed the same opinion in his Seder as well as Rabbeinu Shemaya. So it seems Rabbeinu Shammai also wrote a siddur. And it's interesting, these are people we don't hear of, but this is... in the tractate Midos, which is devoted to description of the Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, and its dimensions, there is a commentary there. It's written, it says Rash on it, Reishin. But there it's taken, this Reishin is Rabbeinu Shemaya. And it says, this is from the tractate Midos, presented together with the commentaries of Rambam. This is the printer says this. And Rabbeinu Shemaya, which he first elucidated in the presence of our master Rashi, may he rest in honor. In other words, when he composed this, he had Rashi look it over. So just interesting. Just finally, this is one final note here, Rabbeinu Shemaya, and we'll go on. We all know that when the first day of Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. First day, if Sukkot falls out on Shabbos, we don't take the lulav. One wonders, what happens if one acts by accident, forgot and took the lulav? Did he fulfill the mitzvah or not? Just say, for instance, you know, we are very careful that when we make a bracha, when we make a benediction, that it's not a bracha of atola. That's not said in vain. What happens with a lot of kavanah? He forgot at Shabbos. He picks up the lulav, right? And he picked it up, and he made the bracha, and he made a shechiyanu, and he took it up and said, "Oops, it's Shabbos." Does he say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Avraham? Does he have to correct it? Was a bracha of atola? When they forbade the taking, does it mean it's non-entity now? Or no, you shouldn't have taken it, but if you took it, you fulfilled the mitzvah. I mean, the difference is, let's say you picked it up the first day. Let's say you didn't make the shechiyanu, but you picked it up. Now comes the second day. Do you make a shechiyanu? Yeah, well, I already fulfilled the mitzvah. Let's say tkiya shofar. You blew the shofar on Shabbos. You know, a little bit of shechiyanu may be a little different. But you blew the shofar on Shabbos. Okay, because the shechiyanu really... For lulav, the Gemara says that actually they made the shechiyanu theoretically when they first bound the lulav. They made a shechiyanu. Then later it came that you took it when you put it together. But actually, since you couldn't make a shechiyanu, even you missed it, but maybe the shechiyanu, you fulfilled the shechiyanu. But here it says, you heard the shofar the first day, you forgot it's Shabbos, you blew the shofar, made the bracha, you made a shechiyanu. Thank God as I came to this time. Now you say, it was Shabbos, I shouldn't have blown it. Now it comes the second day. We don't, you know, this is, to make a shechiyan? Okay, maybe it's fake adiyah, maybe make a shechiyan. But, you know, these kinds of questions, did you fulfill the mitzvah? Didn't you fulfill the mitzvah? You know, how are you supposed to view this? Rabbeinu Shemaya is part of this, an opinion of his is part of this discussion. Rabbeinu Shemaya, how he interprets a passage here, it's based on the Gemara in Sukkah, and the Gemara in Brachas, is that when the rabbis tell you not to do something, they have the power to make it a non-mitzvah. And it's not just to forbid you to do something. But even in retrospect, you didn't fulfill anything. It just, they have the power to be Oker Dover Menatorah, really in a sense, to suspend the mitzvah as if it's a non-mitzvah. Well, if it's a non-mitzvah, I didn't do anything. Well, if you didn't do anything, then you should make a shechiyan. I mean, that would be perhaps, you know, one could give other answers in terms of the shechiyanu, but this is part of the, you know, the dynamics. In other words, when you did this, is it a mitzvah or a non-mitzvah? From this thing with a quote here that we quote on top of page 4, at least there, and this is a part of the discussion, that the rabbis really have the possibility. When they say don't do it, it isn't just merely don't do it, but even it is really not done. And as it's not a mitzvah. And as it's as if the whole Torah was given on condition that the rabbis approve of it. If it's not approved, it's really, in a sense, not a mitzvah. You know, it's similar when we go to a marriage and we say, Hariat Mekudeshes Li, you know, we make the Kedushin, Hariat Mekudeshes Li, Kedosh Moshe of Yisrael. You are betrothed to me, you are sanctified to me. according to the laws of Moses, because Moshe is to the laws of Moses, means the Torah, the Yisrael, and the Jewish people, meaning the approval of the rabbis. And under certain circumstances, the rabbis have the right and conditions to really annul the marriage, based on the fact is that we made the marriage on condition of the rabbi's approval. If they disapprove, it's a non-marriage. Similarly, the idea of Oker Dovman Torah is the whole Torah was, in a sense, given to the rabbis. They have the power to suspend it. We know they have the power to suspend it in situations of invoking martial law, in time of emergency. The normative laws of the Torah are suspended, and martial law is put into effect in times of chaos, of anarchy. And the question is, does this same principle apply here when they just simply tell you, don't pick up the lulav, don't take the shofar? Like, is it a mitzvah or it's just not a mitzvah? Again, this is all, just give you a sense of, part of the contribution of Rabbeinu Shemaya. Another one of Rashi's most outstanding disciples, who preserved much of Rashi's teachings, and also became a mechutin with Rashi, was related to Rashi, was Rav Simcha Vitri, the author of the Machzor Vitri, which we quoted before. The Machzor Vitri is one of the oldest commentaries to the Siddur, and forms the basis for much of Ashkenazic liturgy and custom. Rabbeinu Simcha's son, Rav Shmuel, married Rashi's granddaughter, Miriam, the daughter of Rabbeinu Meir, and Rashi's daughter, Yocheved. Their son was the prominent Baal Tosfos, Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Dampir, better known as the Ri, or Ri HaZoken. Here is what some of the sources say about Rabbeinu Simcha. And again, I just wanted to take some of this to give you a sense of the things that we do are part of Jewish normal custom, as really has to do with much of the decisions that were handed down during this period. One of the things we know is that we, when you have marriage, you have to work about the kibbutim, you have to who to honor. One of the people you honor is the person who reads the ksupa, who reads the marriage contract between the original giving the kedushin, and there is giving the ring, and the Sheva Brachos, and the seven blessings that are said under the chuppah. Actually, there's no mention in the Talmud of this recital of the ksuba. And the purpose of the recital of the ksuba, really, is to create an interruption between the bracha that was made over the cup of wine, the first of the first cup of wine, as the bracha was said, when they made the kedushin, and the second cup of wine, when they made the birchas nesuin. I guess in that time the same person said the same bracha. Well, if you're going to, the same person is going to say the same bracha, and you've already just drank from the wine, there's no reason to drink the other cup of wine. So you need an interruption. Today, really, there's no necessity for interruption because you honor somebody else, generally. At least the common custom is. You honor with some, the one who's the Masadik Kedusha, and the one who you honor with supervising, attending, making the bracha over the Kedusha, in other words, is a different person than the one you honor saying the bracha over the wine by the Sheva Brachas. But very often, and even in shuls, when a rabbi is doing everything, the rabbi says all the brachas. So in such a situation, we need a break. And here we have on page 4, section 2, paragraph A, and this is taken from from the Sefer Yosher, from the responsa of Rashi's grandson, Yaakov ben Meir, Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi introduced a beautiful custom for his generation of creating some form of interruption between the benediction of Erison and Nesuin, as the Kedushin, the Harit Mekudeshesli, giving the ring, and the Nesuin, which is the part of the Sheva Brachas. He can be found written in the Machzor Vitri, which was authored by that generous person, Rabbi Simcha. It largely consists of explanations of Rav Amram Gaon, Halachas Gedolos, Rabbeinu Shlomo Rashi, and other Gaonim. It is commonly available. Rashi wrote this, the Rabbeinu Tam wrote this responsa, Simen Mem Hei, to Rabbeinu Meshulam of Melun, who was a scholar originally from Provence, who moved to Melun in northern France. He was a great scholar, but he was unaware of the customs that were which were prevalent in northern France. And he wanted to introduce the customs where he was from southern France, at Provence. And Rabbeinu Tam felt that it was not correct. And the customs that were created by great people, greater than both of us, and they should be honored. But this is part of this is taken from that response. But again, it's from Rashi. But again, it gives us a sense of what the Machzor Vitri is. The Ri, who was the grandson of the Simcha, writes in a this is quoted from the Mordechai in Moed Kotten. In addition, the Ri, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, respond to the following issue. I have seen in the Machzor Vitri, which was authored by my grandfather Rabbi Simcha, who was a disciple of Rashi of blessed memory. And this is a very interesting thing. We just touch upon this. Now, Lochas of Mourning, where he describes an incident where two people protested the recitation of Tzidduk HaDin on Chol HaMoed. The halacha is, our custom is, there's a long recitation which is said at the gravesite, at a burial, of Tzidduk HaDin, where we express the fact is that despite the tragedy of the death, we realize that everything that God does is just. And there is a question about reciting this on Chol HaMoed, because it takes away from the solemnity of the prayer, takes away from the festivity of the Chol HaMoed. The halacha is, our practice is, we do not say it. In fact, any time we don't say Tachanun, in those days, we don't say Tzidduk HaDin. However, Rashi's opinion was different, and evidently it was hotly debated in his time as well. There was an incident where two people protested. You know, you go, this would be common. There's a burial. Someone wanted to say Tzidduk HaDin, and the other two people over there started shushing him and don't say, shh, you know, don't say it. Rashi stood up and recited Tzidduk HaDin in Kaddish. Now, no one's going to argue with Rashi. He says, and the Ri continued on, if there happens to be a burial on Yom Tov, which is under certain circumstances, you know, we just generally don't do this, but in theory, under certain circumstances, is allowed to have a burial on Yom Tov. I personally see no difference between Chol HaMoed and Yom Tov in regards to this. As the Ri continued on, this is Shalom, Rabbi Yitzchak Ber Shmuel, this is the Ri. But again, this was recorded in the Machzor Vitri, Rashi's incident. In terms about this question of the Gartel, again, on page 6, it just is fascinating, which we see things from a scholarly point of view, that evidently there was an error, either a typographical error, there was a matter of misinformation. Tosfos quotes, again, this question about the gartel or not, this belt. The Machzor Vitri explained that the reason a belt is necessary when reciting the Shemoneh Esrei is so the heart should not see the private area, as we said before. He quotes the name of the Machzor Vitri. We quoted before, this is the name of Rabbeinu Shmaya. This applied in Talmudic time when they had no pants, therefore they needed a belt at the time of prayer. We, however, who have a belt of the pants, do not need any other belt. However, the Machzor Vitri himself says to the contrary. Practically speaking, the Machzor, a person is required to adorn himself before his Creator at the time of prayer, strap himself with his talus, and gird himself with his strap belt, even though he has pants on and his heart does not see the private area. And the Machzor himself took the other position of this argument. And the quote, the Tosfos, was either it was an error or there was a matter of misinformation. As we say, really the source, as we saw in the Tosfos and Brachas, Rabbeinu Shmaya, and it seems the Kolbo from Rashi. Two of Rashi's most prominent disciples became Rashi's sons-in-law. The first was Rabbeinu Yehuda ben Nosson, known as Rivon. He married Rashi's daughter Miriam. His son, Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Falej, a contemporary of Rabbeinu Tam, as we will soon see from the sources, Rivon was a major Talmudic commentator. And as he wrote a just like Rashi wrote a commentary on the Talmud, Rivon wrote a commentary on the Talmud. He preserved Rashi's teachings while at the same time he offered many original interpretations. But it seems clear that it would seem that he was Rashi's disciple to the exclusion of others. In other words, Rashi was his mentor. As we just quote here on page 6 in paragraph A, Rashi's commentary to the tractate Makos was not completed. And in fact, the last words of Rashi on Makos, and this is on Yud Tesom Beis, was Hoyos's Harochitz Tohor, the Tovos of Olo Eichel B'Maiser. A person goes to the mikveh and comes out, even though he was tum, is ritually impure before, at that point, even before the sun set, he could eat Maiser, could eat the Maiser Sheni, the second tithe, which is eaten in purity in Yerushalayim. Those were the last words. The printer just wrote over here, says, Rabbeinu Gufay Tohar, our master's body was pure and his soul left with the words of purity. Those are the last words of Rashi. He did not leave us with any further commentary. From this point on is the work of Yehuda, Rabbi Nosson, his disciple. And then you see the... And he is often quoted. He quotes, he is a source for us to know Rashi's opinions. Besides his commentary, he is a major source to know Rashi's opinions. As we quote here in Tosfos and Chulin, this is in Tosfos and Sanhedrin. What's interesting is, if you look on page 7, in the second, again, this is another controversy I just want you to keep in mind because we're going to touch upon this again. But again, V'oid Pirsha Rajbam Rivon B'Shem Rashi. Again, they're the source of Rashi's opinion. Shekosa B'tshuvas HaGaonim, it's written in the response of the Gaonim, Ki B'zman HaZeh, during our time, in Isser HaNoah B'maga Ovid K'chovim B'yayin. There was legislation in Talmudic times to discourage intermarriage. And it was based really on two things involved. One was they forbade wine which was touched by a non-Jew. One was really to discourage socialization. Well, if you can't drink, you can't have simchas. Wine was a beverage of, was the most common beverage in Talmudic times. If you can't have that kind of relationship, it discourages socialization and promotes really marrying within the ranks. The other consideration was that during that time, Talmudic times, the non-Jews were pagans. One of the methods of service, of avoda, of the pagans was nisuch hayayin, was libations. Normally we think of libations as it was in the temple. You take the wine and pour it on the altar. That was one method of libation. However, there was another method of libation, which was one would just put his hand in the wine and just stir the wine. And that would also be a minor, in their eyes, this would be a form of a sacrifice to the gods. If that would be done, if they actually did that, that would make the wine forbidden not only in eating, but you can't have any pleasure from that wine. That's according to the Torah. Because even if that wine didn't belong to them, and as if a real pagan would come in, take your wine, and then put his finger in it and splash, he would make that wine, we consider this as would be yayin nesach, would truly be a libation for the gods, be forbidden to have any pleasure from this. Because of that possibility, they forbade not only the touching of a non-Jew, not only in drinking, because the socialization part, but also the pleasure. But what happens if you have a non-Jew who is not a pagan? He's not a pagan. Or you have a child that's 2 years old. I mean, he doesn't have an understanding. You know, and that kid, and he's a non-Jew, but he sticks his hand in the wine. How was the legislation, in other words, clearly there's no true concern about libation. So here, as we quote here for this on page 7 here, he says, Bizman hazeh, during our time, in Isser Hano, there is no prohibition of pleasure, b'mago v'kechov and b'yayin, in touching of a non-Jew touches the wine. Ki over the kechov m'shel aksho, because the non-Jews, as I'm going to worship of idols, and those non-Jews, even though widely Tosfos understood that that Christianity, Catholicism, and the belief of the Trinity was a form of idolatry. However, they ain't in regular nasak lavodish kechovim, but that's not part of their service. So they don't do this. So you don't have to be afraid if a non-Jew comes to your house or even touches the wine, just that they did a libation, because it's unknown for, you know, since Christianity became the dominant religion, this libation is really unknown. So there's no real fear of this. And because there's no fear, Rashi maintained the prohibition is only of drinking and not of pleasure. And as the difference is, remember the pleasure of a non-Jew touch wine? Can you sell it now? In other words, you can't drink it, but could you sell it? Could you at least, and there's this thing, you know, there's the preserve the loss. We know selling wine was a major source of income for the Jews in France. Rashi made his, if you ever notice Rashi wine, you know, the picture of Rashi Shul. And we touched on the last lecture, but Rashi made a living from selling wine, from manufacturing wine. And which was very common. But if you can't, then you have to pour it out. He says it's not prohibited in pleasure. It's considered like those who are not, who are absolutely non-idolaters, who don't know anything about idolatry. Like a child, a newly born child, if he would touch the wine, again, it would prohibit it in drinking, because they just made it, you know, across the board. You know, that you can't, because of the socialization issue, they didn't want to make a difference this age, that age, so they just went across the board. If it's touch, you can't drink the wine. However, in terms of pleasure, they did not forbid with a small child. The alze onu somchon, rely upon this. But again, the source, one of the sources for Rashi's opinion is the Rivon. I'm going to touch upon this, because this is really it. This is really a question which touches day-to-day life very often. If you just happen by accident, you happen to have bought non-Jewish wine. Or you have, very often you have the person who becomes a Baal Tshuva. Person has non-Jewish wine. And the person makes a further commitment to Judaism. He says, you know, I can't drink this. What should I do with this? Can I sell it? You know, can I give it to a friend? You know, do I have to pour it out? According to this Rashi, you could sell it or give it to a friend. We're going to find an alternate opinion, but I just, again, want to just touch upon this. Again, the reason there's this treatment of these people is very often we just hear names, just simply to say a name, and he studied from him, and this was, here we have, in a sense, we're getting a sense of the impact that they made. Tosfos also alludes to Rivon's commentary. You know, there's a commentary he wrote to Yevomus, which is alluded to. And Shavuos, I mean, he was understood, he was treated with the greatest respect. In one place, there's a Tosfos in Sukkah, and quote this, Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, it's clear that he added glosses to Rashi itself. That's from Rashi, he made additions to Rashi itself. And he is widely quoted. Unlike Rivon, Rashi's other son-in-law, Rabbeinu Meir, studied not only under Rashi, because the assumption is we don't find Rivon quoting anyone except Rashi. So we assume that was his chief mentor. But Rabbeinu Meir also studied in Germany under the great Torah sages of Lothar, because this was the area where Rashi himself originally studied. There's in Mainz, Worms, you know. Eventually, Rabbeinu Meir founded a yeshiva in Ramarupt, some three parsas, some 6 miles from Rashi's city of Troyes, Twa.
His children, Rabbeinu Shmuel, that's Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam, this is Rabbeinu Yaakov, Tom, because Yaakov is Ish Tom, right? Rabbeinu Yitzhak, Rivon, and his grandchild, Rabbeinu Yitzhak of Dampir, were the greatest of the Balei Tosfos. This is all from Rabbeinu Meir. We find here on page 8, the Shiboleh Leket, the name of Rabbeinu Tam, on top of page 8, I received from my father, my master, Rabbeinu Meir, who received from his masters the Gaonim of Lofa. On paragraph B, we find Rabbeinu Tam testified regarding his father, Rabbeinu Meir. This is on page 8. The one time he happened to come upon non-Jewish wine, and he destroyed it himself. Now, Rabbeinu Meir disagreed with his father-in-law and maintained that, that even though there's an exception for a child who knows nothing, but already an adult, this does not apply to. I just want just to preface, just to understand some of this, the legislation. One of the in rabbinic legislation, there are two dynamics that are involved. One is about that it's a response to a problem, just like we have legislation in Congress and the Senate. There's a response to a problem, and legislation is created. And just trying to understand, not that they created the legislation, trying to understand Talmudic legislation. The other is that when legislation is made, it has to be made in a way that there'll be full compliance. Because one of the problems of our tax code is just it's too complicated. So you want to create a method or a means that basically there'll be full compliance. If there are too many loopholes and too many exceptions, people have the sense of, well, I could do it here, so why can't I do it there? So we have the situation very often of loy plug. They made no distinctions. They had, when they created this, of course, they had to balance that with the factor that any new legislation when it comes to a prohibition involves some sort of a difficulty. Well, before I could do this, now I can't do this. And we have to measure the difficulties, the people's lives, the intrusion in people's lives versus the necessity of making this legislation. So sometimes exceptions are made. Because if it would be met without it, then it would just be too horrendous, too horrific. They made an exception if a small child touches the wine. That wine you don't have to. Or if a non-Jew who is truly not an idolater whatsoever, unless he is truly a monotheist. But for a non-Jew who is really, in the Talmud's view, practices idolatry, who's a pagan, but he just doesn't do this particular thing. And to make distinctions between this pagan and that pagan, that's a question, well, it becomes already too complicated. And how did they, when they made this legislation, what form did it take? They say all pagans, so non-pagans, and as a little child is not a pagan, or someone who is truly a monotheist is not a pagan. But all pagans, no matter what their side of service, if they touch the wine, it's forbidden in pleasure. Or no, we have to deal with the pagans who actually do libations, and those who don't do libations are a different category. That's really the argument here. But Rabbeinu Meir destroyed it. Evidently, Rabbeinu Meir, even though he was close to Rashi, his father-in-law, but his mentors, and this really was from the other school. Even so, Rabbeinu Tam did not want to have pleasure from non-Jewish wine, since a widespread custom was to be lenient, based on Rashi. He felt it was better for them to violate the law through error than on purpose, even though Rabbeinu Tam himself held like his father. But he felt that if he would tell them it's forbidden, they wouldn't listen to him anyway. And there is a general rule when it comes to giving rebuke, that if the people feel that they're in the right when they're doing for it, and you're convinced they're not going to listen to you anyway, so mutav yishoygim, better they do it without knowing, and they'll have less they'll be less guilty, rather than doing this, they're less culpable, rather than telling them and knowing them that then they're just going to violate it knowingly. But again, we quote, you know, from various sections where Rabbeinu Meir is mentioned, there is an addendum to Rashi and Menachos in 13a, which was composed by the Rashbam Rabbeinu Shmuel and his father Rabbeinu Meir. One very interesting facet here, and then we'll go to the next section. We find here on page 9 the closeness that Rabbeinu Tam had with his father, and he gives you an inkling of what existed in that yeshiva in Ramarut. On page 9, there was a question was posed by one of the leading rabbis of Germany, which will be discussed in the subsequent lecture, Rabbi Eliezer Bar Nosson of Mainz. He asked the following question, and we're not discussing the question, which is beyond the scope of this lecture, but it's interesting, the introduction to his question. I am in need of drawing water. It's very poetic, based on allusions from the biblical allusion, Talmudic allusions, of drawing water from the well near the gate court of Yehuda, the place of authority and scholarship. From that well, the sheep will find old and fragrant wine to drink, fresh flowing water from that venerable sage, Harav Rabbeinu Meir. This is Rabbeinu Meir. He was still alive when this question was asked. From that source, the precious and pleasant water branches out into four tributaries. The fourth river is the Euphrates. Now, the question about these four tributaries is a question of historians, what that means. Does that include Rabbeinu Meir? Rabbeinu Meir had three prominent sons. This was the Rashbam, Rabbeinu Shmuel, Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yaakov, and the Rivom, Rabbeinu Yitzchok. Then the fourth would be Rabbeinu Meir himself. And there is an opinion, this is a Gemara in Bechoris and in Hamad Beis, that maintains that the four tributaries that came out from the original river that came to irrigate the Garden of Eden, the fourth river, Euphrates, was originally an extension of the first river. In other words, they poured out, so this is the extension of the first river, and that's how I put the original stream. There are other historians that maintain that he had a lesser known son, this Rabbeinu Meir, Rabbeinu Shlomo, named after his father-in-law Rashi Shlomo, who is, it would seem, based on the name, mentioned in various places, this Rabbeinu Shlomo. And therefore this is an allusion to four sons then, according to this. But the Euphrates then would be speaking about the most important of the four, which was Rabbeinu Tam. But there's a question just how to read this. I am Eliezer Bar Nosson, your disciple who seeks your welfare and inquires about your well-being, as I'm rightfully required to act to my master, eagerly awaiting your answer, which will give me understanding in this matter. Rabbi Meir did not answer this query. It was answered by his son, this is Rabbeinu Yaakov, the Rabbeinu Tam. And he answers as follows, and here we give a personal glimpse into their lives. Even though I continue to cry with a bitter spirit, my strength is waning from all my talking, and no longer see clearly with my eyes, for a month has already passed since the holy ark, the crown of my head, my brother Rabbi Yitzchak, who was his younger brother, was called to the heavenly academy, leaving seven orphans, and abandoning the rest of the living Jewish people, we will nevertheless not refuse to answer the words of Rabbi Eliezer. May it be the will of our Father in heaven that we not be embarrassed or shamed. Even today our talk is filled with bitterness, great as our sorrow. Even our Father is affected. I am writing this at the behest of our Father, may he live. He called upon me, and I, Yaakov, and this is Rabbeinu Tam, the least worthy of the brothers, is writing this with tears. While our brother Rabbi Yitzchak was still alive, he would deliberate these issues with us. The words of wisdom that he would share with us was a source of rejoicing, his original words we heard at Mount Sinai. Seeing that now there is no man of stature to discuss this issue, our voices are raised in thunder, our eyes rain down tears. Rabbeinu Shmuel, his older brother, is not here at the time he's living in Cain at the present time. The rock of Israel should keep us in mind and grant us life. But this was the introduction to his halakhic response. The first and the greatest of the German Bali Tosfos was the Rivot, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Osher. From Tosfos here on page 10, and Tosfos Nida, is clear that he studied under Rashi himself. So he too was a disciple of Rashi. From the tshuva response of the Marshal of Shlomo Luria, it is evident that he also studied sometime under Rashi's grandson, Rashbam. This is Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Meir. And he's widely quoted in Tosvos on paragraph C on page 10. We find that Rabbeinu Tam quotes the Tosvos that was already written by the Rivor Yitzchak bar Osher, at least his disciples. So this is early on already. The Tosvos are written. The first Tosvos were written by this Rivot. We will touch upon him in a later lecture. We will touch upon the Bali Tosvos of Germany. This is devoted, these two, to the Bali Tosvos of France. But again, in a sense, so these were the disciples of Rashi. If you just notice here, just in the back page of our notes, there is a brief outline of who these people were, of the Bali Tosfos. We'll go back to it. But I just want to, now we're going to the next part, I just want to summarize here. We have Rashi, who lived to 1040 to 1105. Rashi's most famous disciples were Rabbeinu Shmaya, Rabbeinu Simcha Vitri, Rivon, Rabbi Meir, and Rivot. Okay? Rabbeinu Meir himself lived approximately the year 1060 to the year 1130. And his most famous disciples were his sons, Rashbam, Rabbeinu Shmuel, Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yaakov, Rivon, Rabbeinu Yitzchak. Which takes us now to the Rashbam. As Tashbatz, as Rav Shimon says, Ben Semach, who was in the early 15th century, he was the leading rabbi in Algiers. He originally came as the leading rabbi in Spain. In the response, is the real name of Rashbam of blessed memory is Rabbeinu Shmuel, Rav Meir, this is on the bottom page 10, of Ramarup, for that was his place. He composed a commentary to the Talmud. It would seem to be that he composed to the entire Talmud. We only know of Rashbam's commentary to Bava Basra from Dav Chof Tes, where Rashi, where it's incomplete, so they quoted Rashbam, and also in Arve Pesachim, the last chapter of the tractate Pesachim, where Rashi's commentary seems to be, we don't have the last, we quoted last time, Rashi, two lectures ago, Rashi wrote three commentaries. This must have been a very early one. It's very brief. Rashbam has a much more detailed commentary, and it is, they are really printed next to each other. But he wrote an entire commentary of the Talmud, it seems. The three brothers, he was the oldest. They were the children of the daughter of Rashi, blessed memory, the famous commentator. It seems also that the Rashbam had a close relationship, even though it seems that he was relatively young when Rashi died. But we see from here the Mordechai quotes that Rashbam derived his decision, top page 11, which he made in the presence of his grandfather Rashi. So already he was a Talmudic scholar, some of the age of 15. He was a prodigy. And we quote here, which we're going to touch upon soon, in terms of Rashbam was a major commentator to the Torah. His approach, as we're going to, was different than that of Rashi's. And he says, even Rabbeinu Shlomo Rashi, the father of my mother, the one who enlightened the diaspora, who made a commentary on Torah, the prophets, and the holy writings, made an effort to explain scripture according to its simple meaning. I, Shmuel, the son of Meir, Rashi's son-in-law, have also debated with Rashi. Imagine he's a little kid. He's debated with Rashi about the simple meaning of Scripture. He admitted to me that if he would have the time, he would have to compose other commentaries to Scripture. These would be based upon the simple meaning of the text, which he gets new insights daily. But evidently, he was very close to his grandfather. And it says here on paragraph B on page 11, this is taken from Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, who was one of the leading rabbis in the 16th century. In the year 1105, the light of Israel Rashi passed away. Rabbeinu Shmuel Rav Meir reigned after him. Probably was not immediately, he was only 15, but he and Rabbi Meir was the was his father and had the yeshiva, but sometime afterwards. This is Rabbi Yosef Dinbrit, or this is, it's quite possible we know of Rabbi Yosef Poras, who was a Talmud of his, and Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Rabbeinu Shmuel's brother, studied under him. Rivo, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Osher, which we quoted before, came to study under him and returned to Germany. Here we quote the again, as we said, that we have Rashbam's detailed commentary to Bava Basra from 29a, and the printer wrote, from this point on begins the commentary of Rabbeinu Shmuel Rav Meir. It's also, it seems, that at the bottom here of page 11, the Rabbeinu Tam quotes his brother. Perhaps he does not have in his possession, this is Simon Mem Hay, this was written to Rav Meshulam of Malun, who was a scholar of Provence, who was not familiar with Rashi and Tosfos. So he refers to not presenting the Tosfos of a Rav Rabbi Yosef, in which my brother Rashbam offers another explanation. This Rabbi Yosef was a Talmud who wrote Tosfos, who included the comments of his mentor. He was, besides his scholarship, Rashbam was known for his great piety, which you can read on your own. This is on page 12 here on the top. We quote from the Mordechai, which gives a very interesting incident in terms of the piety of the Rashbam. But Rashbam is not only known for his great Talmudic erudition. He really paved new paths to the study of Scripture in terms of its simple meaning, beyond the midrashic meaning, which Rashi puts great emphasis on. And here he describes you can read this yourselves, despite the great importance of the midrash, which was implied, and these are meanings which are impregnated into the text, it's also important to realize that one has to understand the simple meaning of the text, which has a life of its own. In terms of how his understanding, though, the simple meaning of the text, the Rashbam's commentary was very often quite controversial. And I would like to just put two points here which are subject of great controversy, discussion. One is on page 13 in paragraph B, the Rashbam's interpretation of the creation story. As you know, this is familiar with the creation story. In the first chapter, after every day, it was evening, it was morning, by Yer, by Voiker, Yom Echod, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi. Most commentators understand, and the Talmud itself understands, that this is really a review of the entire day. In other words, it was how the day went. But a day begins from the evening. A Hebrew day begins from the evening and ends at sunset the next day. That's how Shabbos is, and that is the halachic day. The Rashbam maintained the original day was different. That's different than all the commentaries, and different even how the Talmud treats the passage. It was evening, it was morning. It is not written it was night, it was day. Rather, it was evening. This is because the verse is implying that it first became evening on the first day as the sun set, and after the night of the first day it became morning. Meaning, the morning at the completion of night when the column of the morning arose, thereby finishing the first day of the 6 days of creation, as is stated in Scripture in the Aseret HaDibros, the ten articulation, ten commandments. In other words, he's basically saying when God said, let there be light, and then it became evening, and it was still the first day. And it was night afterwards, and it was still the first day. And then when it became morning, the first day finished, and the new day began. In other words, a day starts, not how we understand the halachic day, but starts from sunrise, continues on after sunset, and ends the next morning. Similar halachically, the day by Kodeshim, this is by the sacrifices, we know that the Laila Holachachar Yom, the night follows the day. You bring a Korban Toda, Korban Chatas, you bring it by day, not by night. And you can keep on eating it and bringing even the remnants on the Amorim, or as is on the altar, and eating the meat until, according to the Torah, until sunrise of the next morning. So here in that, in terms of Kodeshim, the sacrificial rite, we find the day beginning, so the beginning with the morning and ending the next morning. But halachically, everything else, in terms of Shabbos, Yom Kippur, the day really begins at sunset. You know, that's where it begins and ends the following sunset, or when the stars are up. The Rashbam, of course, being a Talmudic scholar, agrees to this, but maintains there was a change in the definition of day from the original creation to the Jewish day. Just like, according to Halacha, the Jewish month, is the months begin with Nisan. The first month is Nisan. Even though originally the first month was Tishrei, was in the fall, when the year begins. But now we count months in terms of Nisan. This is the Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, as a commemoration for the Exodus. We begin at Nisan. There was a change. He maintains counting days was also a change. So according to him, he reads that it just follows, at least in terms of the simple meaning of the scripture, it follows better in a sense. We speak about the activity, then afterwards, it says, after all of this activity, then it became evening, then afterwards it became morning. At that point, the day ended. That's what continued. Afterwards, the second day commenced. Then God said, let there be firmament. The scripture is not coming to say that an entire day consists of evening and morning. It's not looking back. It just keeps on going. The whole purpose is to explain what transpired on the 6 days of creation. So this happened, then that happened, then it became evening afterwards, then it became morning afterwards. For at the morning, at the end of the night, the first day was completed and the second day began. This is the Rashbam's explanation. It is novel. It is different than any other commentaries. The Ibn Ezra was so incensed at reading this that he wrote, he saw this in London and he was visiting. It was 1145 in those years. He visited London. I mean, it was 1154. He visited London. He read this. He was so incensed. He wrote this called Igeres HaShabbos, a letter of Shabbos. He does not mention the author by name. He was very close to Rashbam's brother, Rabbeinu Tam, so he didn't want to. And he knew he was a great Talmudic scholar, but he was livid. And he feels he's destroying everything with this comment. And he felt, based on the commentary itself, that he's incorrect. But again, this was very controversial, but this is the Rashbam. Also, in terms of the simple meaning of the next, L'osal Yadecha says that we put on tefillin. We understand this, and the commentaries explain that refers actually, L'osal Yadecha says, Telvis Bein Enecha refers to the actual putting on the tefillin, the boxes which contain the scripture, which actually put on our hands and on top of our head. According to the profound, simple explanation, Rashbam writes here, this is in Shmos 13:9, it means that the Exodus should constantly be on your minds if it were written on your hand. It's similar to the verse in Shir HaShirim, place me as a seal upon your heart between your eyes. Like an ornament and a golden chain which they use to put upon their forehead for beauty, so it's really just an expression rather than meaning of a... Again, this is very controversial. But the Rashbam nevertheless said it, wrote it. This takes us now to the Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam. And as Tashbat says, again, there were three brothers. Rashbam was the oldest. After him came Rabbeinu Yaakov. He was called Rabbeinu Tam. He was the greatest of all the brothers in Torah. He authored Sefer HaYosher, from which we've come and we've quoted before. After him came Rabbeinu Yitzchok. This is the Rivon. And the Rivosh writes in his response to the second luminary was Rabbeinu Yaakov. This is the perfect man. Ish Tam is the way Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, or patriarch is described. This is, in other words, Rabbeinu Tam. There is no one like him in his power of dialectic reasoning, pilpul, since the completion of the Talmud. The entire Talmud was arranged in his mouth with fluency. He was a veritable Mount Sinai, a man of encyclopedic knowledge, and one who could uproot mountains and grind them together. From his dialectic reasoning, his profound intellect and broad understanding, all men of wisdom would tremble. From his mouth and the mouths of the other great luminaries of France do we live. He continued on. In addition, Rabbeinu Tam was a man of tremendous stature. He was at least the equal of the Halachas Gedolos, Shiltas, Rabbeinu Chananel, and Rashi, or perhaps even their superior in his acuity and knowledge. And he doesn't put it's understood in the as it would seem from his original insights. All the Talmudic scholars that are alive today are but the peels of garlic or the seeds of assessment in comparison with one of his most minor disciples. It's interesting, from the preface of his work, Rabbeinu, the Sefer HaYosher, we find an interesting approach that Rabbeinu Tam took. I call this work Sefer HaYosher, this is a straight, Yosher means straight, upright, straight, because in this work I've straightened all of the original Talmudic topics through the original texts. He took issue with the fact that in the previous generations, when they had problems with the text, they felt that the text was in error and they corrected the text. Now Rashi, my grandfather, would never make a correction of the actual text. Even though he felt it was in error, he would just write it in his commentary, he felt it was error, but the actual text, except with the exception of Zvachim, which he corrected, he did not make any changes. He would only write in his commentary, this is the correct version of the text, Hochi Garsinim, or this is an incorrect textual reading. It was those who drank his waters, however, who corrected the text based upon his commentaries. May Hashem forgive Rabbeinu Shmuel, my brother, because for every one of Rashi's corrections, he made 20. In addition, he actually erased the manuscripts of the Talmud and made corrections. I also know that he did this due to his great powers of dialectic reasoning, profound understanding, but Rabbeinu Tam took great issue with this, and he felt that one should be very conservative to make any corrections of the text. In all probability, even though we have problems, it is correct, and we have to reason out rather than what the meaning of the text is, rather than just flippantly to make changes. He was also, as we quoted before, and this is the response of Ben Meshulam of Melun, again, who was originally from Provence, a great scholar, who wanted to make changes in practice based on his practice, the customs in Provence. He says, I beg of you, do not divide our kingdom to separate halachic entities, for we all drink from the waters, Ben Shlomo Rashi. Merely by basing yourselves on things without substance, do not scourge this place. Do you think we are merely neophytes, Katlakanya, reed shoppers of the swamp, should not take the honor of our grandfather into account? Please, my brother, do not do evil. And in terms of, we find, says, who were the people he impacted on Rabbeinu Tam? I found an old collection of manuscripts. Rabbeinu Tam had many disciples. Amongst his great disciples, Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz, which we'll discuss in future lecture, Rabbeinu Peter, Rabbeinu Yitzhak HaZaken, which is his nephew, sister's son, Rabbeinu Moshe Pontois, Rabbeinu Moshe of Evro. This is probably an error because Moshe of Evro, or maybe it's a different one, that we know lived much later, Rabbeinu Moshe Bar Shlomo HaKohen of Germany, of Mainz. This is taken from the Chidah. The Marshal says, again, gives a more exhaustive list of his disciples, which most of them are quoted in the Tosfos. Benu Tam reigned after Benu Shmuel, Harav Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans, he is going to discuss English's Jewry. We'll touch upon him. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Boruch, Harav Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, this is Rabbi Yosef of Orleans, Benu Chaim Kakohen, Rivom, Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Meir, Rihalovan. This Rihalovan was one of the first great scholars in Bohemia. Ri of Dampir, Rav Binyamin of Calabria, it's not clear who he is, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Mordechai, Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz, this is Rav Moshe HaKohen of Jerusalem, all his disciples, Rabbeinu Eliyahu of Paris, now he's speaking about his colleagues, Rabbeinu Eliyahu of Paris, Rav Menachem Bar Peretz of Yohane, Rav Chizkiah of Al-Sur, of Meshulam of Melun, which we discussed before, Rav Ephraim of Regensburg, were all his contemporaries. He also had, Rabbeinu Tam, a warm relationship with Ibn Ezra, which you can look at, which we discussed in the lecture about the Rami Ibn Ezra. He was also very wealthy, Rabbeinu Tam. Ma'aril said, he testified about Rabbeinu Tam, is on page 16, paragraph H, that when he wanted to learn the essential principle of difficult halacha, he was having a lot of problems and he got depressed. In other words, he's working through something and it's not going. He put a pile of gold coins in front of him in order to give him joy, to feel, to make his heart expansive, to be able to learn with all his might. Very interesting. In other words, like, don't feel so down, Baruch Hashem, you're blessed with wealth, like, keep on going, you know. Sometimes you're going through something difficult and you feel like you're totally, you know, you're lacking in any, you know, any mental facility, and you just, what am I doing? Interesting, he was a man of wealth. There's a fascinating incident which was recorded of Ephraim of Bun describing the Second Crusade, which we will touch upon in a further lecture. On the second festival day of Pentecost, or Shavuos, the errant ones from the land of France, this was in 1146, gathered at Ramaru, and they came to the house of our master, Rabbi Jacob, Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbeinu Tam, Elib, and took all that was in his house. I realized he was a wealthy man. They ripped up a Torah scroll before his face and took him out to a field. There they argued with him about his religion and started assaulting him viciously. He was about to be killed. They inflicted 5 wounds upon his head, saying, like the stigmata, "You are the leader of the Jews. Take vengeance upon you for the crucified one and wound you the way you inflicted 5 wounds on our God. His pure soul would have perished were it not for the mercy of our Creator, who had mercy upon him on account of the merit of his Torah study. The Lord caused an eminent nobleman to pass through the field, which our master Rabbi Jacob was to be found. Our master called him and offered him a bribe of a horse worth 5 zakukim." He still kept his wits about him. The nobleman went, spoke to the errant ones, there's nothing like money, and persuaded them, saying, "Leave him for today and I will speak to him. Perhaps he will be tempted and we shall succeed in swaying him. Should he refuse, know that I'll hand him back to you tomorrow." Of course, he didn't hand him back. He got his horse. They consented, and the evil hour was thereby averted. Thus God, in his compassion for his people, had mercy upon him who propagates his holy Torah amongst them. He also, it seems, wrote a machzor we have in paragraph J. He enacted various legislation, various acts. I didn't bother because of the length of them to translate all of them. If you look at them yourself, the second one is fascinating in terms. It seems that this occurred about the year 1150. Because Acher Masher Somer Benu Gershom, this is on paragraph 2, this is on page 17, this is section K. On number 2, Acher Masher Somer Benu Gershom Shal Yisa Ish Shteinoshim, that he enacted excommunication for a man marrying 2 wives. Ein latir el b'mei anoshim. This is the heter mei rabbonim, that you need 100 rabbis to allow this dispensation, that a person is allowed to marry a second wife under certain circumstances, where he can't marry the first wife, she became insane, whatever the difficulties are. Megimel malchus has to be from 3. He enacted it has to be from 3 separate kingdoms. Just to make it even more difficult to get this. Onio, I think this is Anjo. So the Nornadia, this is came. It must be Normandy. Tsarfas in France. Even though they're technically all part of France, but France, probably the king of France, actually had his rule really of the Ile-de-France, which was really a very narrow area around Paris, Orleans, Paris. Normandy, which was on the coast, was really under the control of a Duke of Normandy, which is a separate. And Anjou had a Count of Anjou, which was separate. It would seem, though, that it was just historically that this occurred before the year, it would seem, before the year 1154, because then Henry II became King of England, and he was the Duke of Normandy, the Count of Anjou. He took care of everything, and it would seem then that Anjou and Normandy all became one. So it would have to be in an area that we looked at as separate kingdoms, evidently, and had separate governments. The Gamla Yatir Oisat Shiru Tam Lahetta, they can't just sign it. They have to see a valid reason why it's allowed about the second wife. Gamla Yatir Oisat Shiru Tsurur Monachas Mashkonis of Moyes has to be in a situation where the ksuba is all set, that he doesn't just do it to avoid the ksuba. For whatever reason that he'd be allowed to do this, she refused to get a get, and she's and there are grounds for divorce, whatever it is, but they have to see a proper thing, and all everything has to be set up. It says the 13 enactments are listed here. In addition, he has on paragraph L, in the bomb paragraph L, there was another legislation that was made. This was together with 150 rabbis, including himself, Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Shmuel, Eliezer Bar Nosson that we had before, who 150 rabbis. One is not to take a position, even though it's appointed by the royal authorities, unless there's a consent of the congregation, of the community. As they wanted to avoid that the kings, the royalty, imposing Rabbonim or Dayanim on the people. It shouldn't be there. It has to be with the approval of the community, and this is very stern. There was also here you have it. You can look through the English here on page 19. There was also an addition about the one who marries. There was a question about a person who marries a woman. She dies in the first year, in terms of returning the nadin, returning all the monies that were given. Normally, on Talmudic law, the husband inherits the wife. But there was a special legislation here that anyone who marries a woman who dies in the first year without live children should return the entire dowry and jewelry to those who donated the dowry or her heirs. Rabbeinu Chaim Cohen, who was his disciple, said of the Rabbeinu Tam that had he been there at the funeral, even though he's a Kohen, he felt that he would be allowed to attend the funeral. This is one attends for a father. One would be allowed. He felt he was. They explained like he was the Nasi Hador. He was the prince of the generation, and one would be allowed in that circumstance. Others disagree because based on interpretation of a Talmud Yerushalmi. The Ri HaZaken, who is the. This is to distinguish him with a younger Rabbeinu Yitzhak, we'll touch upon later. Was the next after him was the next leading Baal Tosfos, the leading rabbi. And as it goes through that the quote from Tashbats, Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam, Ribbono Shel Olam, children of the daughter of Rashi, the famous commentator Rabbeinu Yitzhak ben Reb Shmuel, on page 20, we call Reb Yitzhak HaZaken. Baal Tosfos was the son of their sister, the grandson, the daughter of Rashi, blessed memory. Rabbi Elchanan was the son of Rabbi Yitzhak HaZaken, and his son was Rav, Rabbi Shmuel, of blessed memory. The Marshal is a list of the great disciples of his. They're all listed again in the back of the. We'll go through just one moment. The great disciples of Rabbeinu Yitzhak of Dampir. The Rosh held him in the highest regard. And in terms of the Rambam, the Rosh writes, referring to the Rav Yitzchak HaZaken together with the Rif and the Ravid, they were superior to the Rambam in wisdom and numbers. This is the Rosh writes. Not that I have the power to define who is greater, but rather is based upon what we've heard and received. Even though others would probably take issue with that, but evidently the Ri was held, this is Rabbeinu Yitzchok, in the greatest esteem. Again, this is the generation after Rabbeinu Tam. This finally here, on page 21, which is a fascinating, in the look of how life was in the yeshiva of Rabbeinu Yitzchok, my French masters bear witness. This is written by Menachem Ber Zerach, who originally became a great rabbi in Spain, is originally born in Provence around 1310, and went on to Spain. My French masters bore witness in my presence in the name of their masters. It was well known that 60 rabbis studied under Ri. Each one of them understood the lecture, and besides the lecture would individually learn a tractate that their colleagues did not learn. So everyone memorized one tractate. There are 60 of them. There's basically 60 tractates. This they would review and master by heart. There was not a halakha they did not collectively know. As everyone, collectively, the entire Talmud was before their eyes at the time of Rabbi Yitzchok's lecture. And as Rabbi Yitzchok would be quoting a Gemara, not all of the students were familiar with the Gemara, but some of them were, because this was. All of the doubts that were brought up were clarified. So if there would be a problem, at least somebody there could challenge. Any halacha or statement made by a Tana or Mora, which was cited somewhere else and seemed to contradict the passage of Talmud in discussion, resolved and corrected properly. This is evident to anyone who sees their Tosfos, their questions and answers, their explanations and their criticism, which they critique their grandfather, Rabbeinu Shlomo Rashi. But many of the questions that Tosfos brings up from this Gemara and that Gemara and the other Gemara were actually brought by these experts, because each one was an expert in an individual tractate. So collectively, the whole Talmud was discussed. And not necessarily the others were not familiar with the other, but here we have one who memorized the entire thing by heart, every line and every word. So I would just now, just to go to the final page here, the Bali Tosfos, and just to review this and open this for questions. Rabbeinu Tam's most famous disciples we touched upon in the class. He lived probably from the year 1100 to the year 1171. Found Rabbeinu Yitzchok of Dampir lived from the year 1120 to the year approximately 1200. His most famous disciples were Moshe ben Shlomo of Germany, who was also a disciple of his uncle, Rabbeinu Tam, Rav Shimshon of Sens, Rav Yitzchok ben Avram. These will all be discussed in the next lecture. Rav Baruch, Rav Yitzchok, who authored the Sefer HaTrumos, Rav Yehuda Bar Yitzchok of Paris, which is in the next lecture, and Rav Shimshon of Kusi, so the Count of Kusi. The rabbis we cover tonight represent the beginning and probably the greatest, the most original period of the Bali Tosfos. In the coming lectures, we will continue studying the lives and times of the authors of the Tosfos, their spiritual descendants. In the next lecture, we discuss the unique relationship of the Bali Tosfos and the resettlement of Eretz Yisrael, and touch upon the difficulties which the Jews experienced in Western Europe that made such a move to Israel necessary. Now, are there any questions? Yeah. So we find one of the first collections of the Tosfos that we have was the collection of Rabbeinu Shimshon of Sens, who was in the Shimshon of Shans, the Shorash Mishans. His Tosfos, it seems in Rosh Hashanah and Sukkah, it seems in Menachos, they really took his collection. There was a Relozer of Tuch who took the material originally started from Rosh Mishans and expanded upon this. In other words, he condensed his Tosfos and added to it. And many of the Tosfos, especially in the large famous Masechtas, are from this Tosfos Tuch, the Lezer of Tuch. There were other Tosfos written from other yeshivas which found their way, which printed on the, we don't have the Rosh's Tosfos, the Rosh Mishans, or the Tosfos Tuch, which took from the condensation edition, is not in all the tractates. And there were other Tosfos written at later times. So the Tosas really are different collections of these comments, which span the, from the probably from the beginning of the 1200s to the end of the 1200s. There basically are different collections.
Is it like a leaf book, and each one of them that is listed in the Bible, like the Rabbanan, the Rabbin, they all had their full commentary and only the best of was taken?
No, not necessarily. Some of them had full commentaries. Others were just, when they studied in the yeshivas, they studied, and this was the lecture. And in the lecture, they said, Rabbeinu Tam said this, and they copied it over. And these are lecture notes. The last of the prominent Tosafot we have on Tosafot on Yoma is from Rav Meir of Rutenberg, Rama Rutenberg, who died in the year 1293. That's his Tosafot, as he took from the previous and added to it. So it's really the Tosafot that we have are the works of these French or German scholars from the. The composition was in the beginning of the 1200s to the end of the 1200s, but they are quoting scholars already from the beginning of the 1100s. They quote Rabbeinu Shmaya, we went from the Machzor Vitri, they're quoting Rivom.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.